Israel carries out fresh air strikes on the Gaza Strip, targeting two areas south of the besieged enclave. The point-blank shooting of a Palestinian by Israeli forces in the West Bank sparks outrage in the occupied territories. The U.S. defense chief says Washington will not let China use its power to reshape the international order. Hey everyone, welcome to World News. Here in the Iranian capital, I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Israeli aircraft have performed fresh air raids on the besieged Gaza Strip. We were joined by our correspondent there, Ashraf Shenner, a short while ago, for more on those attacks.
Then Israeli fighter jets attacked Hamas security posts east of the southern Gaza Strip town of Rafah and west of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, because of extensive damage to those locations. While Hamas sources said that the attack targeted farmlands, the Israeli regime claims that they attacked rockets targeted military tunnels and training center, as well as arms manufacturing areas in southern Gaza. The Israeli regime claims that the airstrikes were retaliation for fire that was fired from the Gaza Strip, although no one has claimed responsibility for firing such a rocket, while Israeli media was saying that those who fired the rocket were members of the Islamic Jihad's military wing, Al-Quds Brigades, in retaliation for the brutal killing of a young man in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus by an Israeli soldier.
In the meantime, Palestinian activists and social media users calling for a response to the Israeli killings and crimes. They demand that Palestinians ramp up resistance and fight the occupation. The campaign has been launched in reaction to footage emerging of an Israeli soldier shooting a 23-year-old Palestinian four times at point-blank range at a checkpoint in Nablus. He was left bleeding to death while Israeli forces prevented medics from reaching him. Now, reacting to that incident, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process has called for perpetrators to be held to account. Tor Wennesland says that an immediate investigation should be conducted into the Israeli killing of Palestinians. Hamas resistance movement has also vowed revenge. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says that Israeli troops are under orders by their military commanders to shoot and kill Palestinians.
Everyone knows very well, not only the Palestinians, the European Union, the international community, know very well that Israeli soldiers are using their guns to shoot and kill people. They have clear orders from the Israeli military establishment, knowing at the end of the day, none of the Israeli forces who commit crimes against unarmed people would be tried or would be taken to court to achieve justice. That's why if the Israelis continue and go on with this policy, then they themselves would be dragging the whole area to another circle of violence, returning back to, let's say, another form of an armed uprising, not only a popular intifada.
The people in Bahrain have taken to the streets in protest against a visit by Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog to their country. We've discussed that in our news review program.
And now welcome everyone up to News Review Program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. People in Bahrain have taken to the streets in protest at the upcoming trip by the Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog to their country. Protesters gathered in several areas of Bahrain on Friday, chanting death to Israel. They also carried signs with Herzog's image, calling him a criminal. Opposition activists launched a campaign on social media as well, speaking out against the normalization of ties with Israel. Herzog is set to arrive in Bahrain this Sunday. he'll be the first Israeli president to visit the Arab country. Bahrain, along with the United Arab Emirates and Morocco, normalized ties with the regime back in 2020 under a U.S. brokered deal. Move sparked Muslims' anger, who called it a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. And now joining us for the program is Saeed Shahabi, political analyst, joining us from London, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. And Mr. Shahabi, after Isaac Herzog visits Bahrain, he is set to go over to the United Arab Emirates. He's been invited there as well. Two entities that normalize ties with the Israeli regime. My question to you, sir, how are they better off? They were both aligned with Western countries before the normalization. They both enjoyed Western support. They both had collaboration with Western intelligence and security agencies. So basically, the normalization of ties, the UAE and the Israeli regime, the Bahrainis, and you know very well, the Bahrainis have the Fifth Fleet. They have Western soldiers on their soil to give them protection, to basically keep the Khalifas in power in Manama. So what do they gain from this except hurt and upset their people?
First of all, since the beginning of the year, more than 200 Palestinians were killed by the Israelis. Number two, in the past week alone, there were more than 8 Palestinians killed, murdered by the Israeli occupiers. Number three, the regime of Bahrain feels weak, because any regime in the world will always feel weak if the people it is governing do not support it. So the people of Bahrain have no love for the Al Khalifas. They do not like their rule because they are oppressive. They are hereditary dictatorships. They are not relying on their people. They are relying on the foreigners. And now they think that their position will be strengthened by the arrival of the Israeli politicians and also the Israeli soldiers and security men. They are now, both of them, Bahrain and the UAE, they feel that their position, their situation will be made much stronger if and when the Israeli soldiers and security apparatus set foot on their land. Of course, we know that the Arabs and Muslims have rejected this. And we know that only last week in Qatar, we saw the flag of the Palestinian people all over the stadiums. And there were so many chants against Israelis. And the Israeli media people could not get a single Arab or Muslim, or indeed a free man or a free person from any part of the world who was ready to speak to them, to their media. Once they know that this media belongs to the occupiers of Palestine, they just say, no, we'll not speak to you. And this is what was reported in the Israeli press, that we realize that we are not loved by the others, which is true. They are only loved by the regimes, by the dictators of Bahrain and the UAE. And that is the tragic position. And we do not believe that the regime will become stronger. We believe that the people will prevail at the end, because their voice is the voice of truth, voice of justice, voice of freedom, voice of Palestine.
Thank you, Mr. Shahabi. And Robert, the leading... the head of the opposition there in Bahrain, Sheikh Isa Qasim, on this visit said, "Our proud people should say no to the desecration of the land of faith and dignity by head of the Zionist entity." Now, Robert, we're hearing words like treason and betrayal leading up to this visit. To Mr. Shahabi's point, will the people ultimately prevail, if not today, tomorrow? Because this is the invitation of one family, the Khalifas. But the people do not want it. But somehow that's the landscape here in the Middle East. So-called champions of human rights and democracy in the West seem to really like it when they only have to give a dictate to one family and not really care what the people in the Middle East care about.
Yeah, that's the Western way. Certainly the United States and other countries only want to deal with the governments. They want to keep those governments strong and have them repress their people so that the Western countries can do what they want throughout the Middle East, whether it's stealing oil, disrupting other governments that don't follow the U.S. dictates, such as Syria and Iran. And they want to make sure in that whole part of the world. The fact that the people are, again, rising up against the government does indicate that I agree that eventually they will prevail. It may not be today with this visit by the Israeli president, but a regime can only be so repressive for so long before the people finally say enough and rise up, risking their lives, many of them dying in the effort to free their nation. I think we're going to see that in many of these countries that are simply ignoring the will of their people, and especially ignoring the will and aligning themselves with the criminal apartheid regime of Israel. The Arabs who live, these are Arab countries, mostly Muslims, they understand what Israel is doing to the people of Palestine, and they are saying enough. It's time for our country to stop doing this and to support the human rights of the Palestinian people. Also, you asked about what benefit there is for them. I have to wonder what the United States promised Bahrain and other countries in exchange for this. Donald Trump was very anxious to make these alliances happen, and it was probably very costly to the United States to do so. But in the end, the governments of these countries will have to answer their people. In most of these countries, it's not going to be at the ballot box. It's going to be in the streets.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us there. Mr. Saeed Shahabi, their political analyst, joining us from London, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. And that brings us to the end of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
All right, let's move on. The United States suggesting it's ready to use military power to maintain its international dominance that's being challenged by China. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin made a comment as the Pentagon unveiled its latest stealth bomber, the B-21 Raider. Austin said that China has both the will and the power to reshape the U.S.-dominated international order. He warned, however, that Washington won't let that happen. Austin added that the U.S. is aligning its military budget to the China challenge. Washington and Beijing are locked in a tension over a host of issues, including what China calls the threat posed by the U.S. strategic shift to East Asia. Beijing says it's ready to use its military strength to dash attempts to challenge its rising power. The South Korean president is ramping up measures to counter a prolonged strike by truckers. He has ordered preparations for widening a back-to-work order beyond the cement industry. The decree will also affect oil refining and steelmaking sectors, where additional damage is expected. President Yoon Suk-yeol has called for the punishment of those violating laws and orders ministers to take action to minimize damage. He slammed the walkout for Tuesday as politically motivated and said that the strikers are holding the people's living and national economy hostage. The strikes have been going on for more than 10 days that disrupted supply chains, costing well over $1 billion in lost shipments. The government saying it will not expand the minimum pay system for truckers beyond 3 years, but the unions insist it should be permanent and wider in scope. Now, Indonesia raising the warning on the Semeru volcano to the highest level following an eruption, spewing a column of ash high into the air. Authorities are now warning residents not to conduct any activities within 8 kilometers of the eruption center. People living near the volcano in East Java are being evacuated. The volcano began erupting on Saturday with its plume reaching a height of 15 kilometers. The eruption on the eastern part of Java follows a series of quakes on the west of the island, including one last month that killed more than 300 people. A Turkish court had jailed a convicted member of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party days after a student extradited him. Mahmoud Tat was arrested upon arrival in Istanbul. In 2015, he was sentenced to more than 6 years in jail for being a member of the PKK. He then fled to Sweden, but Stockholm rejected his asylum request. Sweden and Finland seeking to join NATO after the Russian attack on Ukraine. Turkey is yet to ratify their membership. Demanding those countries take a tougher stance on Kurdish groups in exchange for its backing. Ankara regards PKK as a terrorist organization It has called on Stockholm to take action on issues including the extradition of criminals and freezing of terrorist assets. Now we've talked to political commentator Scott Bennett and asked him if Sweden's attempt to join NATO would bear any fruit for it, and here's what he thinks.
In one sense, it's also futile because Scandinavia, specifically Finland and Sweden, will never be insane enough, despite the suspicions otherwise, but they'll never be insane enough to wage a military confrontation or allow missiles to be deployed onto their land that would put them into an endangerment situation with Russia. So I think even the NATO absorption of Scandinavia is really futile because it's more, you know, a part of the West's psychological game and psychological warfare against Russia. But Russia's already essentially won, so that too is, I think, going to peter out.
Now, France says that the West should respect Russia's need for security guarantees if Moscow agrees to negotiate to end the war in Ukraine. President Emmanuel Macron says that Europe needs to prepare its future security architecture, adding that Moscow's concerns must be addressed. Macron says that the West has to prepare how to give security guarantees to Russia and at the same time protect its allies. The United States and Russia say that they are open to talks. Moscow says the West's support for Ukraine, including NATO enlargement and missile deployments near its borders, have to stop before any negotiations could take place. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, December 4th, 2022. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. And if you have any message for our great listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and here we've received reception reports from around the world from N. Arun Kumar from India, Vlad Vinogradov from Russia, and Valentin Boratuno from Romania. N. Arun Kumar, Vlad, and Valentin, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio and your favorite program, Listeners Special. And of course, we've received piles of letters and emails from around the world, which I mention some of their names here, and later during the program, I will read these letters or emails. We've received an email from Muhammad Briel from Malaysia, one of our old and regular listeners. From Luxembourg, we've received an email from Serge Till. Muhammad Aslam from India has sent us an email from Norway. We have an email from Radar Bo, one of our old and regular listeners. And the last but not the least in this program, we have an email from Lithuania from Thomas Biliaskas, one of our old and regular listeners. Stay with us, please. I will be back with these emails. This is Listeners Special, and we've received, as I said, piles of letters and emails from around the world. Now, here we have an email from Malaysia from one of our old and regular listeners, from Muhammad Bria. Let's see what Muhammad says. Thank you for your email. I still prefer to receive a paper QSL card. Inshallah, you will continue to post paper QSLs, although I do understand the cost factor and delivery problems should IRIB decide otherwise. EQSLs are okay. Thank you for your efforts. Kind regards from Malaysia. Salam and warm greetings to you, Muhammad Riyal from Malaysia. And thank you very much for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio and Listeners Special. Please accept our electronic QSL as verification. We wish you all the best. And as always, we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And of course, we are looking forward to hearing from your opinions and attitudes about IRIB English Radio programs. Thank you, Muhammad Briel from Malaysia. And from India, we've received an email from Muhammad Aslam. Let's see what Muhammad says. Dear friends, thank you for your cooperation and good reception. I appreciate your shortwave programs, specifically those related to Islam and society. God bless you. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Muhammad Aslam from India. And thank you very much for sending this message to IRIB English Radio and the program Listeners Special. Of course, we thank you for your support to IRIB English Radio, Muhammad Aslam from India. God bless you too. Write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. Welcome back. From Luxembourg, we've received an email from Serge Till. Serge says, Dear staff, few days ago, I listened to your English program from 21:29 UTC to 22:45 UTC. I am located in Kolmarburg in the center of Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. Can you please send me a QSL card or even an EQSL to my address? Thank you in advance and stay in good health. Salam and warmest greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's good to hear that you can receive our signals in your region, Kolmarburg, Luxembourg, as you noted. Of course, we will send you an electronic QSL as verification, and we wish you all the best. Serge Till from Luxembourg. And of course, we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon and know about your views and attitudes about IRIB English Radio programs. From Norway, we've received an email from Radar Bo. Let's see what Radar Bo, one of our old and regular listeners, says. Hello again, dear friends. Gladly, I still listen to your English language programs. I like your commentaries and news bulletins. I have also attached a 60-second recording that was made at 1924 UTC that includes station announcements. The signal was very strong, without interference from other stations, but the audio quality was not so good, in my opinion. Any QSL cards would be very much appreciated. Thank you very much in advance. Salam from Tehran to Radar Bo from Norway, and please accept our warm appreciations to you for writing this email, Radar Bo from Norway. And thank you very much for letting us know your opinion about your favorite programs. As you noted that you like the commentaries and news bulletin. That's great. And you were also pleased with the quality of the signal, but you didn't like the quality of the audio, which will be checked by our experts very soon if the problem is on our behalf. We will send you an electronic QSL as verification. Radarbo from Norway, we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, and we wish you all the best. And after a short break, I will be back with you, dear listeners. Welcome back, and for your information, what you heard was a piece of music from Northern Iran. Well, from Lithuania, we've received an email from Thomas Biliauskas, one of our old and regular listeners. Thomas says, "Dear IRIB, I am a shortwave radio listener, and I would like to send you next reception report of your broadcast. It was difficult to listen because of weak signal and large amount of atmospheric noise. Sound of program was quiet and atmospheric noise overshadowed it. I tried it several times to listen to your English and other language programs, and it was the same. The sound of program is too quiet and muffled by noise, so it is very difficult to listen to your broadcast. I continue to follow the events of your country, and I'm wishing all the best for you. If you find the information given in my report is correct, I would highly appreciate to obtain your QSL verification card. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and thank you very much for this email, Thomas Biliauskas from Lithuania. We take your advices on the quality of the signal and the audio to our heart and fix the problem if it is on our behalf. Thomas Biliauskas, also thank you very much for your beautiful prayer. We also wish you all the best. Please accept our electronic QSL as a verification and write to us soon. And dear listeners, before we wrap up this edition of Listeners Special, I do send my warm gratitudes and appreciations to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters from around the world, including N. Arun Kumar from India, Vlad Vinogradov from Russia, Valentin Bradatono from Romania, Thomas Biliauskas from Lithuania, Mohammed Riel from Malaysia, also Mohammed Aslam from India, Serge Chil from Luxembourg, and Radar Bo from Norway. Dear listeners, many thanks for being with us. Please keep in touch with IRIB English Radio and your favorite program, Listeners Special. We wish you all the best. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to englishradio@irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Akhwai. When it comes to the UK, the headlines couldn't be worse and in some cases shocking. For example, UK Royal Mail workers and university lecturers begin fresh strike as inflation skyrockets. Or another headline, Britons turn to pet food amid cost of living crisis. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether things are as dire in the UK as it seems to be, and as the headlines indicate, and whether the government headed by the multimillionaire Prime Minister Sunak's austerity budget can even come close to fixing the UK's economic crisis. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Saeed Mohsin Abbas joins us. He's a journalist and political commentator from London. Also joining us is Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, also joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Clive Menzies. Taking a look at how things are in the UK, obviously the headlines paint a doomsday scenario, but as we keep getting news, it just seems like it's getting worse. For example, the latest being that things are likely to get worse before they get better. This comes from the Bank of England, which is why I'm introducing this to you in form of a question, where it says it's predicting a lengthy downturn. And in addition, Britain was the only group of seven economies yet to recover fully from the COVID slump. Are things as bad in the UK as the headlines are indicating?
Well, I think the question is phrased in terms of relative growth by inference, saying that Britain is taking much longer to recover. But I think this is much less to do with competition between countries and much more to do with something far more overarching, which is essentially we've been predicting this collapse and hyperinflation for some years now because of the way in which central banks have been printing money like there's no tomorrow. And it's quite instructive that I think the alarm bells were ringing in the summer of 2019. Mark Carney, who was very much part of the architect of this crisis in waiting, resigned from the Bank of England on the 15th of March 2020 and gave a hospital pass to the rather intellectually challenged Andrew Bailey, who as recently as July 2022 was saying that our job is to keep inflation at 2% and that's what we'll do. Clearly, the Bank of England's economists And more importantly, the governor of the Bank of England hasn't a clue as to how this all came about. But those who were disinterested and not part of the club that are benefiting from what's been going on over the last 3 years could see this coming a mile off. In terms of how bad things are, we were predicting back in the summer that in the autumn things were going to get very bad and we're going to go through a very deep economic crisis. But the good news is that increasingly there is visibility of the corruption and criminality, the amount of money that has been laundered, for want of a better way of putting it, through this manufactured COVID crisis, the climate narrative, which is also false and has been used under the cover of COVID to basically turn cities into ghost towns. I spent most of my time during the so-called pandemic moving around London as I normally would, and the place was deserted. So in terms of economic crisis, it's no wonder when they deliberately collapse the economy.
All right. Well, Seamus and Abbas, I don't know if you agree with what Clive Menzies there said, but one thing that caught my attention, I want to ask you, is that there was a certain class there that was aware that the UK economy will be at least facing the situation that it is, and it made off from this and profited from this. Because some things don't make sense, like the GDP of the UK registering at $3 trillion or over $3 trillion. But yet, you know, you're having what you're facing right now. So something maybe is not making sense. And, of course, there are guests also talking about how, you know, it may be the rich that are really making out here, generally speaking. I mean, this figure in terms of the GDP and the fact that the UK is facing what it's facing really it points to a great economic inequality, which the UK has been plagued by.
Well, Britain is the biggest offshore tax haven, and it has the Corporation of London, the City Square Mile, which is one of the biggest money laundering, regions in the world. It acts essentially as a place where the rich and the powerful and the corporate sector hides its money, does its dirty deals. Most of it is beyond the law. In fact, that square mile has its own jurisdiction, everything from the Lord Mayor that presides over it through to their police there, through to whether the British government can even ask questions of those huge corporations and the huge amounts of money that pass through there. And London itself has become really, it's awash with dirty money from every corner of the world. And yet, at the same time, that same Corporation of London actually has probably 30%, if not more, Clive might correct me, of the hold on the GDP of this country. So they can switch off the button in Britain very, very easily if these huge players are upset in any way, or if the British government doesn't toe the line of the City of London. Westminster has far less power, I would really argue, than that corporation itself. So that's one thing. But that controlled demolition of the economy, which Clive certainly hinted at, if not started opening up on, you only have to look at the sequence of events. You know, when they first flooded Britain with migrant workers from Poland and from Europe, I mean, there was a huge sort of issue at the work front at that time. But then what they've gone and done is the Brexit thing. They've done the migrant restriction on labor. They've gone into this Ukraine war without thinking. They're part and parcel of the U.S. sanctions on Iran and other places, so they can't do business. Their own companies can't do business with major economic powerhouses around the world. The COVID overreaction and the way they dealt with that was diabolical in and of itself. And of course, the background to all this is the Great Reset, which we can't ignore. The context of all of this is that actually globally, this idea of digital money coming through, the idea of totalitarian economies, China style, if you like, the emergence of AI, there are a lot of things that the big, rich, and powerful money mafia, as I describe them, want to happen. And part of it is to really teach people a lesson, bring down their expectations, have them at each other's throat with economic worries while they get on quietly over the next 10 years, continuing to readjust the entire economic and political, if you like, landscape according to their requirements.
Okay, well, you just mentioned Brexit there amongst your statements, and I have to ask you, Clive Menzies, about what the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has said on trade. Let me be unequivocal about this. Under my leadership, the UK will not pursue any relationship with Europe that relies on alignment with the EU laws. He says, I voted for Brexit, I believe in it, and I know that Brexit can deliver. But Brexit has not delivered. So why is he beating the drums on something that seems to be a failed policy at this point?
Well, the whole Brexit debate is worthy of a program at least on its own, because there was no Brexit, there is no Brexit, there will never be any Brexit as long as this existing structure persists. What we had was all the things that were a matter of convenience for ordinary people like me to travel and to do business in other countries. Those have been restricted, but we are in lockstep with European policy on Ukraine, on finance, on law, on everything. So what Rishi Sunak is claiming is an outright inversion of reality. And this is a charade or pantomime that's been played ever since 2016, where I would have suggested in hindsight that the election of Trump and the referendum on Brexit were primarily to divide the 99% who were beginning to realize that we weren't run by governments and there was no political reality, that actually money power rules everything. And in order to fragment that coming together, if you like, both Trump and Brexit were very effective in dividing populations down the middle. But the reality is there is no Brexit. It's an illusion. And what Mosin was referring to in terms of this Great Reset, this is all in lockstep. Everything's happening together. So any pretense that, you know, we're not doing as Europe are doing, I mean, you only have to look at the Netherlands and the way they're closing down farming, and they're doing the same over here. This is a war on us all, and this is a war between centralized power, which is primarily, as Mosin says, in the hands of those who control money, and the rest of us. And most people are unaware that we're in this war, uh-huh. But increasingly I'm finding on the ground that more and more people are awakening to this. So their plans are not going to work, and that's good key. News that we can take away from this.
Exactly, and that's key, said Mohsen Abbas. To put it into a couple words, people power. Taking a look at what the strikes are going on in the UK on a variety of sectors, the ambulance strike, we're looking at the UK Royal Mail workers, the university lecturers, are the most recent strikes amongst a host of other sectors that have gone on a strike in the UK. Now, you know, these people are not, I mean, this is basically because of the inflation, their pay is not keeping up with it. So isn't the government worried about this? Or should I say, aren't the people in the higher echelons, the 1%, worried about the fact that people are going to turn against them?
Well, I imagine they are worried, but at the same time, there's one thing that you often see. That these folk who are at the in that upper echelon, they tend to profit whether there's chaos, conflict, war, or peace. They always seem to be, in some way, pulling the strings. One hopes that the, as Clive in a lot of his research has put together, this notion of withdrawing consent. One hopes that if the public awakens and they withdraw consent from these exploitative, usurious, quite psychotic institutions and individuals that are in control, then there's hope. And of course, those people, if they did wake up to this reality, then what they're trying to implement on the ground, which is that in birthplaces like Burnley today, we've got 50% of children who are living in absolute poverty, according to certain definitions of poverty, which is, I think, below 60% of inflation-aligned median income. That was in 2010-11. But things like this, things like old people now having to turn off their heating, you know, skipping lunches, not having holidays anymore, having to spend their savings in feeding kids. These are all realities on the ground which are already hitting home. And if they carry on, then one hopes that people will dig deeper as to why this is all happening, and they will react and respond. And these strikes are no bad thing. This awakening of people in terms of realizing that the political economy is geared towards the billionaires, who we all know became, and it's all proved that they became hugely rich during COVID and post-COVID. So it does seem as though even now Rishi Sunak is taking it easy on those rich folk, because they're not, I mean, their tax reliefs, et cetera, the caps are being taken off. They're allowed to sort of do what they like. And whilst they may be trying to soften the impact of energy prices, waking the people up and creating, huge problems for the government, it may not be enough. People may hopefully wake up and see that the actual systemic problems will not go away by trusting the established structural elite, as we often say.
You mentioned the town was Burnley, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Burnley. I'm going to ask you, Clive Menzies, when it comes to some of the testimonials here, because we have to cover this. Skipping lunch each day and watching TV in blankets to keep warm is not how this couple really imagined their retirement to be. Rationing cups of tea in the face of soaring energy bills, of which Burnley, happening in Burnley now, one of the most deprived areas in Britain, are spending more of their income on essential goods. It has seen the sharpest increases in prices than elsewhere. Are we looking at this as being the worst-case scenario, just unique to this particular town, or is it widespread in the UK?
I'm sure that the people who have been playing by the rules of what Mosen described as the money mafia, because they set the rules, the whole economy is geared around harvesting people's energy and resources and whatever wealth they can accumulate. And basically, there will be a lot of people who will suffer as a result if they continue to play by the rules. But what is actually happening is that people are beginning to realize that things like council taxes, utility bills, and debt are optional as to whether you repay them, because the whole system has been created to harvest our energy and resources, and people are beginning to wake up to that. And I've not been able to verify this, but a sizable swathe of the population in the north of England has ceased paying their council taxes. And this is just the beginning. I won't go into the lawfulness of council tax, but it is unlawful, and more people are beginning to realize that. So there are many ways in which people are fighting back. And the way that people will be able to work through this and begin to thrive is by forming communities separate from the structures and the authorities that they live under. Because there is, an economic crisis doesn't destroy anything other than money, and money isn't worth anything. It's the food and all the infrastructure and all that we need to live on that is important. And people are forming their own groups and communities to provide healthcare, to resist the unlawful demands of the system, and to grow their own food. This is all beginning to happen. Food cooperatives, cutting out the retailers from eggs, for example. There are farmers who produce eggs, and the supermarkets play them so little that it's not worth their while to produce them. Well, now sure. Communities are forming to go direct to the farmers. So this system is going to be bypassed, and it's going to collapse, but it's going to take time, and there's going to be death and destruction in the meantime.
Well, I mean, it's getting pretty bad here, say Mohsen Abbas, when you're having reports such as people resorting to eating pet food come out in the news and making the news. So it's got to be pretty bad at this point. Now, you're looking at the Chancellor of the Exchequer saying that poor households should be spared much of the pain and cuts to public services. But then you have the central government funding for Burnley, since we're talking about that town, to have fallen by £5 million a year since the year 2013 through 14. That's about a third. Now, if that's happening to the poorest of towns, then that's a pretty bleak picture. Does Rishi Sunak understand, or through his exchequer understand, the depth of desperation that towns like Burnley are in?
I think they fully understand. I think that they take their orders, as we say, from forces much higher than them. And once you have that scenario where Britain is having to go in line with the policies that are being set by corporate money mafias that are outside of Britain, and they are essentially usurping the British electorate's democratic, you know, rights, and they are usurping Britain's independence, economic independence and political independence, essentially. That's what they're doing. But it's all being done in an underhand way in the background. So the fact is that Rishi Sunak and these people and the government itself, I believe the civil service, I mean, they've been in this business for centuries. They know very well how things work and how the Treasury certainly isn't, you know, some would say they might be manned by half-wits, but I rather suspect that they do know, but they are under orders to run the policies that they are and have been. So the net result really is, you know, at the end of the day, you've got inflation 12% rising over the last year. And don't forget, the austerity that was going on during the Tory term over their term here has been ongoing already. And there were huge, before COVID, certainly there were huge rallies that were picking up against the Tory austerity lie, as it were. And those are now obviously going to return, I think, in a much bigger way, one hopes. But what's more important is that people need to look more deeply about the elitist classes which have been constantly put back in power. If Starmer from the Labour Party comes into power, he's not any better. He's also beholden to exactly the same systemic corruption. And it's a nonsense that where these two-party systems in most of the democratic world try to fool people that in some way there is some choice, and they play this kind of good cop, bad cop, right. You know, austerity versus releasing the burden on the masses. This game has gone on long enough, and I think that it's high time people really woke up to the fact that there needs to be systemic deep change in the way we operate our political economies.
Okay. Well, both of you have mentioned this great reset. Now, I'm assuming the reset, Clive Menzies, is the one that the WEF put into motion, not put into motion, introduced or got some coverage that was of a major degree across the media, in a sense. Is that the great reset we're talking about, where it's to green energy? And my question, aside from that, is how the U.S. is playing a role in leading Europe down a path where it's actually but it's affecting the industries and factories in Europe as a whole through its initiative, which is green in nature in terms of the Inflation Reduction Act, where companies from Europe are relocating to the U.S. Can you put that into the Great Reset scenario for us, if you can?
In a short time, that's quite difficult. But I think when Mosin talks about choice, the late great George Carlin, comedian, said, it's a big club and you ain't in it. You don't have choice. You have owners. And essentially, the fact that, you know, we can refer to the US and the US and Europe having some sort of competition, and certainly with what's been happening with the sanctions in Russia, Europe has been sort of thrown in at the deep end, and it's going to suffer severely, and has been made to commit some sort of energetic or economic suicide as a result. So there is this inter-country competition, but this is universal. You know, the Americans are suffering, or will suffer, no less than Europeans and Brits and anybody else who's caught up in this Great Reset. But the Great Reset is about recasting the way in which the world works, because the game that has been played for centuries is that in order for economic growth, you go and plunder other countries. Well, all the countries have been plundered. There are now too many people, in their view. There aren't too many people if we had a rational economic system.
Right.
But in their view, because it's a hunger games economy where there are always more losers than winners, then they're resetting the turf, one, to reduce the population, and the green agenda is very much part of that. Net zero doesn't mean net zero carbon. And, you know, we are carbon life forms. It means net zero people. In other words, let's reduce the number of people. So that's part of it. The other part of it is actually because there are more people than there are functional jobs to do, and there are many jobs that actually don't actually produce wealth, then it's about substituting, as Mosen said, AI and robotics for people.
Sure.
So this is all part of the Great Reset, but it's a big, complex issue that needs much more time.
Definitely,
to
definitely. What a bleak world we live in. A final question. Say, Mohsen Abbas, looking up UK economic crisis through this software we have for news here, the thing that came up was how you have Britain's Prince William, Prince of Wales, and Catherine, Princess of Wales, arriving for the 2022 Earthshot Prize ceremony at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, you would think if the UK is mired in an economic crisis of this proportion that we just covered, it seems like the priorities are misappropriated when it comes to, let's say, the prince. Am I correct to put it that way? Less than a minute.
I think we can say that royalty is part of that elitist structure. They're the most visible, and they get easily, of course, targeted. But in reality, if you were to go to the clubs and private accommodations in Mayfair of most of this elitist mafia in London, they're not going to be affected by the bread prices and by the prices of milk going up the way they are. They're not going to be affected by energy or heating.
Okay.
They don't care. The reality is it's the poor man, it's the people on the ground that are suffering, and they need to really fight
with
the resistance economy. Globally, resistance economy, fighting the system in that way is necessary now.
Thank you so much. Sorry to cut you. We're just fresh out of time. Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapway and the team, it's goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, where welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have a very special guest speaker, Dr. Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about a strange topic based on the Holy Quran, and that is the movement of the mountains. How is it possible, Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is referring to a verse in chapter An-Naml, verse 88, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala explicitly talks about this kind of movement of the mountains. In this verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ وَتَرَى الْجِبَالَ تَحْسَبُهَا جَامِدًا. And you see the mountains, you think them to be solid, without any movement.
Yes.
But Allah says, وَهِيَ تَمُرُّ مَرَّ السَّحَابِ, and they shall pass away, or they shall move as the passing away, or as the movement of the clouds. صُنْعَ اللَّهِ الَّذِي أَتْقَنَ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ, the handiwork of Allah who has made everything thoroughly. إِنَّهُ خَبِيرٌ بِمَا تَفْعَلُونَ, surely He is aware of what you do. So, this is true. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala refers to a kind of movement of the mountains in chapter An-Naml, verse 88. Now, there are different explanations of the exegetes of the Noble Book of Quran, the scholars of Tafsir, both Shia and Sunni scholars. And of course, we have some explanations